Welcome to the Debate at Geo8 podcast series exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and, by extension, Australia's economy and our society. My name's Ron Cantelars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer. And throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics, touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. Today, we'll be exploring the amazing work done by the University of Queensland on venom research. With me in the pod booth studio is the Geo8 CEO, Vicky Thompson. And joining us online is Professor Glenn King, Principal Research Fellow at UQ's Institute for Molecular Bioscience. He and his team have been researching the use of venom to treat a range of conditions, from chronic pain to the prevention of heart attacks and strokes. Professor Glenn King, thanks very much for joining today's podcast. It seems a little counterintuitive to use venom from a deadly spider for pain relief or to prevent damage caused by heart attacks and strokes. You know, how does all this work?
Yeah, look, it's a good question, and that's generally what people say to me. But the reality is there's already six drugs that have been derived from the venoms of animals. The first of those was a blockbuster drug. So all modern antihypertensive drugs derive from a molecule that was found in the venom of a Brazilian viper. So that viper is deadly, and even though it's killed a small number of people, it has saved many more lives through the molecule we got from its venom. So while it may sound strange to be looking in venoms for therapeutic compounds, people have been doing it for many decades and have been successful in some instances.
What's a blockbuster drug?
So a blockbuster drug is a drug that these days the definition has probably changed. In those days, a blockbuster drug was a drug that brought in more than $1 billion in sales per year. So that was happening with this drug in the late 80s, which was, it was an extraordinarily successful molecule in those days. The molecule is called Captopril, by the way, and it's still used, still widely used as an antihypertensive drug 30 years later.
I understand you and your team have been working on this sort of research for 21 years or so, and the University of Queensland is now home to one of the largest venom libraries in the world. How did that come about?
Look, we started working on venoms in the mid-90s, and those of you that are older, like me, will remember that's about the time when we started to realise there was a crisis with chemical insecticides, in the sense that we realised some of them weren't good for our health, weren't good for the environment, and that insects were actually becoming quite resistant to many of them. And we were looking for new ways to develop eco-friendly insecticides. And my thought at the time was, well, surely spiders have worked this out a couple of hundred million years ago. Surely they must have molecules in their venom that would be good for killing insects. And so we went looking for such molecules. And of course, all the spiders had compounds that will kill insects. And the question was, did they have molecules that will kill insects but not kill us or birds or fish or even bees? And we were able to find these sorts of molecules. And we spun out a company in the early 2000s called Vesteron Corporation, now based in Michigan, the United States, that has now successfully developed compounds from Australian funnel web spider venom that are very safe and are being used in crops in the United States.
So it may seem like a strange question, but as a young boy growing up, were you always captivated by these strange elements of nature, spiders, snakes, etc.?
Yeah, I actually was. So I actually went to an agricultural high school. So in Sydney, there are two agricultural high schools, James Roos and Hurlston. And so I went to Hurlston. And it was a wonderful school. We had 300 acres. It was a living farm there with cattle and sheep and chickens and the whole nine yards. And I got really interested in bugs in particular, not specifically spiders, but invertebrates more than vertebrates. But it was a long time before I was able to go back to that passion. My career started as somebody interested in structural biology and cancer in particular.
You're commercializing some of this research at the moment. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we were looking to try, I mean, the problem we have with stroke and heart attack is they are the two biggest killers in the world. So about 30% of all deaths every single year all around the world are due to those two disorders. And yet we don't have a single therapeutic molecule for treating either of them, which is a singular failure, if you like, of modern medicine. And so we're trying to find molecules, particularly trying to find targets that might be useful in the context of those injuries. They're both ischemic injuries where there's a lack of oxygen supply to the tissues. And so we found what we thought was an interesting molecular target, but we had to find a molecule that inhibited that target. And so, as usual, we went looking in our venom collection, and we were pretty agnostic about where the molecule might come from. We have venoms from spiders, scorpions, assassin bugs, hymenopterans from all around the world. And the winning molecule turned out to come from the Gari funnel web spider. So the funnel web spider came up trumps again. The molecule we got from its venom was about 50,000-fold more potent than the best known small molecule inhibitor of that channel. And when we looked at it in the context of an ischemic stroke in rodents, we found that if we gave it within the first 4 hours after the stroke, we could diminish the brain damage by 80%, which was remarkable.
Wow.
And then we went on to show that it also was efficacious in the context of a myocardial infarction, a heart attack. And so on the basis of, and it also is incredibly good at maintaining the integrity of donor hearts that are destined for transplantation. So on the basis of all of that, and preclinical data, we founded a company called Infenza Bioscience. The name Infenza comes from the spider from which the molecule was discovered. And Infenza is now set up at the Translational Research Institute in Brisbane with a view to trying to get into clinical trials for heart attack by the end of 2023.
Can I ask you about the team that sits alongside you and behind you? Because it sounds to me like it would be fairly multidisciplinary in terms of the research that you're doing. And I'm just wondering, in terms of that multidisciplinary, how that actually works and whether that's working in a really positive, functional way. Because, you know, research is never linear, as you know. You find these surprising mm-hmm. things as you go along. And, you know, one of the challenges we often have in talking to some of our funders, for example, is they want to know that you're going to start here and you're going to end there and it's going to be a product and you're going to commercialize it and it's going to make lots of money and save lives. But of course, the journey is often, you know, sort of, you know, hills and vales. So I'm just wondering about the team that's sitting alongside and behind you in getting to the startup and the spin-off that you've talked about.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the team is really critical. I think it's really important that there's good science underpinning the company, but without a good team, it's not going to go anywhere. I think, as you say, well, academic science is somewhat non-linear. I think drug development has to be somewhat linear. There are certain absolute things you must do, and that's regulated by things like the FDA in the United States and the TGA here. So the pathway is pretty clear in terms of the things you've got to do, for example, in terms of toxicology and safety. But you need to have a team to implement that really knows what is required. And we were really lucky to recruit as our CEO, Mark Smythe. Mark Smythe was most recently the founder of a company called Protagonist Therapeutics, an Australian company that at one stage was valued at about $2 to $3 billion on the NASDAQ. It's got several molecules currently in clinical trials. And Mark's been involved in about five companies, all developing peptide therapeutics. So he knows the space, he knows what's required. But the biology, as you say, Vicky, is a bit different. You know, nobody's developed a drug in this space. And so it's critical we had good biology as well. So we have Nathan Palpant, who's an expert in cardiac physiology, also here at the IMB, is our head of biology. And he's been really critical for developing this in the cardiac space. But we have a really fantastic board of directors as well, and that includes Bob Graham, who ran the Victor Chan Cardiac Research Institute for 26 years, and his expertise is actually in myocardial infarction. And we have a fantastic scientific advisory board that provide expertise across stroke, myocardial infarction, drug development. Marie Smith, for example, is an expert in the toxicology space, and she'll be advising us in that area. So you're right, the team is really, really critical, and we spent a lot of time trying to get that right.
And I know you've co-founded the biotech company Infenza Bioscience, and you've raised, I think, $23 million to develop the drug to clinical trials. One of the things that we often hear about is the lack of appetite, patient capital, if you like, you know, because it's a long time between research and delivery. And I'm just wondering, how hard was it for you and your team to raise that money and raise that capital, both from an actual practical way, but also in terms of the environment in Australia and the policy environment that we've had in the past in terms of research, R&D, and then commercialisation?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think there's a lack of patient capital in Australia. It's a long process. I think the VC environment is limited in Australia. The venture capital environment is limited compared to, say, the United States. And the patient, they're less willing to take risks, particularly in an area like this, which has been a graveyard for drugs, admittedly, but also huge potential opportunity for that reason. So we decided to go in a quite different direction. We felt that this was an area of such significant medical need that there would be people, high net worth individuals, who'd be interested in investing, both for the potential to make money, but also for altruistic reasons as well. I think we've all been touched by somebody who's had a stroke or a heart attack in our family or circle of friends. And so we raised the $23 million entirely from high net worth individuals in Australia. So it's a purely Australian-based investment. The federal government has done some very good things in terms of encouraging investments from high net worth individuals. And so we are classed as an early stage innovation company, and that gives Australian investors very significant tax advantages, including tax-free capital gain over the first 10 years of the company, as well as some tax deductions in the first year. I think that's been really helpful in terms of getting high net worth and investment, and hopefully we set a paradigm here that that's an alternative way to try and get money into Australian companies.
That's really interesting, Ron, because that is quite a different way to raise money. And what we often find with some of the examples from the Group of Eight, and of course we're the big research-heavy universities in Australia, is that a lot of that capital raise has to happen overseas. And what happens is, in fact, I was just looking at a list of spin-outs and from our universities. We're doing a piece of economic analysis on this. And I think I got to about 20 big companies, like I think you mentioned one, which is worth sort of $2 to $3 billion in the US, to kind of get that funding, they've had to go overseas.
Yeah.
And one of the things that, you know, the former government was trying to do, and I think, you know, there's also absolutely with this government and the minister that we have now a commitment to this, is to set up a good commercialization fund, a translation fund. Mm-hmm. And you'll recall we've talked on this podcast to
many
Ian
times.
Jacobs about that. Yep. We've talked to Dean Moss about that, you know, to provide some of the seed funding to kind of get this underway. But this is a really unique proposition, at least as I would understand it, Glenn, to actually target high net worth individuals to keep it in Australia, fund it in Australia.
Yeah. I think your point, Vic, is absolutely right. And we were offered the entire amount by a single venture capital firm, and that would have required us to move the company to Boston. And one thing that we're really passionate about is trying to develop the biotech ecosphere in Australia. We had too many examples of companies going offshore. We wanted to try and build it here with Australian capital, with the company based here for as long as possible. We'll do our phase one clinical trials in Australia. And I think it's only if we have more companies doing that, we're going to develop the biotech ecosphere in Australia. And that's not going to happen if everybody keeps going offshore. And so we rejected that offer. It would have been
that must have been pretty hard, was it?
Well, it was, but we already had some passionate people who wanted to get involved, and we felt it was worth putting in the extra yards to keep it in Australia, to tackle some of the things that perhaps aren't going to make a lot of money, like heart transplant. We think there's a really great opportunity to make an impact in that space with Peter McDonald down in Sydney, who's one of the world leaders in heart transplant at St. Vincent's, and Victor Chan. He's one of the founders.
The Australian aspect to this is quite important too, because when you look at Australia, with, you mentioned 30% of the population at some point, you know, impacted by heart attacks, etc. And here in Australia, with the tyranny of distance, particularly in regional communities, this sort of technology, which gives people a better chance of survival, also means that the transplant organs can be more effective for longer. It is game-changing technology.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, there's two things that we think are really important here for people in regional areas in particular. So the first thing is that there is one molecule that's used in the context of stroke. It's a clot-busting molecule called TPA. So it's an attempt to enzymatically break up the clot. The problem is there are two types of stroke. There's an ischemic stroke and a hemorrhagic stroke. And you can't give this to people with a hemorrhagic stroke because it will make it worse. And what that means is the paramedics' hands are tied. So when they have somebody having a stroke, they can't do anything. They just have to get the patient to hospital. They have to image, and then their brain gets imaged. They determine what type of stroke it is. And then your neurologist will make a decision about whether to use the drug or not. The problem is for somebody that's stuck out in a regional area, they're losing 2 million neurons per minute on the way to hospital. So a lot of the brain is being damaged already. We see no reason why the drugs we're developing can't be used by first responders. They won't be of any concern to somebody with a hemorrhagic stroke. And we think that's going to be a real game changer. If a paramedic or the first responder can give drug to the stroke patient, wherever they are, they're going to get benefit, even if it takes 4 hours to get to hospital. But also in the context, as you mentioned, of heart transplant, you know, if there's a heart currently in Perth, a donor in Perth, you're not going to get it to a recipient in Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane because a heart only lasts for 3 to 4 hours. So there's not enough time to recover it and get it there. We know with our drug, we can keep the heart for at least 8 hours. So we think that'll also be a game changer in terms of making more hearts available to people.
And it's such a simple idea, it seems to me. I mean, the problem that's bedeviled people in the past is that after a heart attack or stroke, the body, in a sense, attacks the heart and shuts it down. I was reading some research, talked about, you know, the suicide mode. And basically your molecule prevents that from happening.
Yeah, so what we think happens is really interesting. I think most people don't appreciate that when you have a stroke or a heart attack, your organ has to change the way it metabolizes its fuel. And it reverts to this very ancient metabolic pathway called anaerobic glycolysis. It's the same thing that happens when you're working really hard in the gym, you can't get oxygen to your muscles fast enough, and you revert to this pathway, and that builds up lactate, and that's that burning sensation you get when you exercise. Now, you can clear that lactate pretty quickly, and then, as you know, that pain goes away fairly rapidly. But if you've got a clot in an artery leading to the brain or heart that's causing that, you can't clear the lactate. And what that means is your brain or your heart becomes acidic. And so the molecule you were targeting is called acid-sensing ion channel 1A. It actually notices the acid, turns itself on, and then it in turn turns on a suicide pathway and causes the brain nerve cells or heart muscle cells to commit suicide. And as you correctly point out, what our molecule does by preventing the channel from switching itself on is just preventing the downstream suicide pathways being turned on. And we think that's why we're salvaging nerve cells in the case of a stroke or heart muscle cells in the case of a heart attack.
So, Vicky, if you want an example of the relevance of research work done by GO8 universities, it doesn't get any better.
It's all there, isn't it? You know, you've got a multidisciplinary team. You've got a company which has raised funding from, you know, high net worth individuals, which in and of itself is interesting around, you know, the policy environment that we have here. And of course, you know, in terms of where the government's going at the moment, in terms of commercialization, I know they want to hear more of these stories. I mean, I'm captivated by it. It's fascinating what you're doing. I'm interested to know also, when do you think you'll be able to go to clinical trials? What's your time frame there?
Yeah, look, it's a fairly aggressive time frame. Look, the preclinical data is really, really good. We have efficacy in a number of different species across many laboratories. And our principal concern is manufacture of the molecule. And that's something I think most academics don't think about. You know, we're used to working with proteins and peptides and small molecules on a milligram scale. You know, we're now talking gram scale, and if we make it into the market, we're talking kilogram scale. So that's a whole different world of manufacturing challenges.
Just to interrupt. Are you saying we don't have that manufacturing capability here at the moment in Australia at scale?
It's probably not well developed at scale. Yeah, that's correct. There's very few possibilities in Australia. And that's not to say we're not exploring those opportunities.
Sure.
We'd love to be able to make the drug in Australia. And certainly we are working with one group in Australia to try and do that, but there are limited options available in Australia for manufacture of these sort of complex molecules.
And it is a very complex that could molecule. Be a handbrake on the next step. And this is where developing that ecosystem is really important.
Absolutely right. Yeah. I think sovereign capabilities in terms of drug manufacture are really, really important. And I know there's a lot of talk about that at the moment, and I think it's a really important discussion, and I think we need to definitely develop it further. And so that is our biggest risk, but nonetheless, we're aiming to try and get into phase one clinical trials by the end of next year, and those phase one clinical trials will be done entirely in Australia, and then phase 2A clinical trials, which will be done in patients that do have one of these STEMI heart attacks the following year, and that will be a multinational, multi-centre trial.
The other thing I want to talk to you too about is chronic pain and the work that you're doing in that space, and the work with marine cone snails, and you use the venom from those marine creatures. And just a couple of things that really stood out for me, that chronic pain is suffered by 1 in 5 Australians, and that some of the material from the marine cone snail has shown to be very, very effective, in fact, much more potent than morphine, and it's non-addictive. Mm. So it seems to me, Glenn, that again is game-changing research.
Yeah, there's a lot of work in this space, and certainly we are very interested and have been interested in treating chronic pain for a long period of time. It's a big issue. We have lots of drugs for acute pain, but for people that suffer persistent pain, and as you said, that's 1 in 5 worldwide, most drugs don't work. So even the strongest opioid analgesics don't work long-term for these patients, and then they cause serious side effects like addiction. So we've been interested in that for a while. We've really moved our attention to some important untreated pain that affects large portions of the population. So we're very interested in the pain associated with IBS, and more recently the pelvic pain associated with endometriosis, which affects a huge number of women. So that's been our focus. We have molecules that have really good efficacy in treating both of those types of pain, and we're working with AusHealth, who are based in South Australia, to try and take those molecules towards commercialization. So that's, I think, the next big area for us in terms of commercialization.
What about pain associated with neurological illnesses? And I have to declare a conflict slightly. I'm on the Multiple Sclerosis Australia, MS Australia board, and I have personal experience with a sister who has long-term MS and is in chronic pain, and nothing works. And I'm just interested to know, are you looking at it also in terms of the impact on neurological diseases which cause chronic pain and lifelong pain?
We've not been looking at pain in the context of MS, but what I can say is a very close collaborator of ours has shown that the molecule we're actually developing for stroke and myocardial infarction is efficacious in the context at least of rodent models of MS. And that's been, there's been a lot of conflicting data out there about this target in the context of MS, but the data that I have seen confidentially looks fairly robust. And so that's an exciting development. So that's not targeting the pain directly, it's actually targeting the MS, the autoimmune disorder itself.
How do you find out that the marine cone snail has a venom that's going to be so, so wonderfully important when it comes to chronic pain? And I suppose that really emphasises the fact that you guys have this, one of the largest venom banks in the world, is so fundamentally important.
Yeah, look, I think it comes down to the fact that, obviously these animals aren't trying to, develop analgesics for humans. Many of these molecules actually cause pain or have other effects in their target organism. They typically target things called ion channels, which are on the outside of our nerve cells, that let ions like calcium, sodium flow back and forth. And the classic example is a drug that's actually been developed already from cone snails, an analgesic drug called ziconotide. It's available now and it's used by patients who failed long-term on opioids that have chronic pain. So it's kind of a drug of last resort. That molecule in the context of the prey of the cone snail is deadly. It kills fish, and it works on a channel that is at the neuromuscular junction of fish, and it completely paralyzes the fish so the cone snail can eat it. We have that same ion channel, but it's not at our neuromuscular junctions anymore. It's in the spinal cord. And in the spinal cord, it's used to transmit pain messages to the brain. So whereas that toxin is deadly to a fish, in us, it's actually an analgesic because we're using that same ion channel, but in a completely different context. Mm. And that's why some of these molecules that are even deadly in the context of the venomous animal can actually be beneficial for a human.
And so fundamentally important. That's why the venom bank is so fundamentally important.
Yeah, yeah. So we when we have a target that we think is interesting therapeutically or even as insecticide, we still work on insecticides and think that's an important problem. We screen our venom collection against that particular target. And as I said, we're pretty agnostic about where the molecule comes from. We just want a molecule that has the right pharmacology. It just so happens the Australian funnel web spiders have been remarkably good at turning up molecules for us. And we don't know why, but we do know it is one of the most complex chemical arsenals in the entire natural world. So the venom of the Australian funnel web spider can have as many as 3,000 compounds in it. It's extraordinarily complex.
And hence the reason why the sovereign capability should be here in Australia, because it's our spider.
Absolutely, our spider.
So that's a nice segue to a question I've got sort of coming, you know, a bigger picture question around you know, research and researchers. So how I came across this probably says more about me than anything, and this and you and the Venom Centre or the library, was some issues around one of your, I think one of your PhDs who had some issues getting a visa because the Department of Defence, I think, deemed it as potentially a area of dual use technology in some way, and yeah. You know, which is a perennial issue, not just for this centre, but we're dealing with it right now. It's just, you know, you've got people in bureaucracy reading sort of research topics and making decisions, and we're quite concerned about it. On top of serious delays where we're losing researchers who, you know, are sitting waiting for sometimes 12 to 18 months. And they've been funded by the Australian government, actually. This is the irony. They may be funded by the Australian Research Council to come over and undertake some research, you know, as part of a partnership. Mm. And then another agency of government is holding up their visa. So one arm of government funds them and one arm holds the visa up. And of course, what that means is those researchers, they'll just go elsewhere and we lose that great capacity. And so in this case, it was a Chinese national who did her honours degree at UQ. So she'd been at UQ for the whole time and she'd received a PhD scholarship in the area. Yeah. I mean, what's your view of all of that? Because we lose that fantastic capacity. And as I understand it, I think you've lost that person. Is that right?
We've lost that person. Yeah. So that person's a brilliant student. Mm. They produced, I think, 6 papers during their undergraduate research degree, which is extraordinary.
Which is extraordinary for those who don't know. That is quite a lot.
So that is a clear misreading of her research topic by some bureaucrat.
She was coming here to work on what we just talked about, developing therapeutics for chronic pain. Because she was going to be working on venoms and, you know, you can call those things toxins, if you like, the compounds found in venoms. She was actually declared unfit to study in Australia on that topic because she might be developing weapons of mass destruction. It was the most absurd decision I've ever heard, and it shows a complete lack of knowledge at the government level about what the research entailed. But there was no recourse, there was no ability to challenge that decision. In fact, we did. We wrote many letters explaining what the research was about. It fell completely on deaf ears.
And where's she gone?
She's now doing a PhD in Japan.
So, see, we've lost that capacity.
Yeah.
We've lost that brain, which is so unfortunate. And as you say, because a bureaucrat sitting there and just has no understanding.
Yeah. And yet you see this work has such a profound impact on daily lives. It again, all of this research, whether it's pain management, stroke research, whatever, heart research, it just points to the fact that many of our universities are doing work which is changing our lives on a daily basis.
Absolutely. Look, I think there's no question that Australia is cutting above its level in terms of research output, in terms of innovation. The issue is the translation and the pathways that are available, both in terms of funding and of universities not really at the moment providing an easy pathway for people to do what I've done, for me to become the chief scientific officer of the company while simultaneously holding my academic post has been extraordinarily difficult to achieve. and required me to jump through many hoops. I think we want to see more academics jumping in and out of companies and translating and then going back and doing what they do well in the discovery space. And I think at the moment that's actually quite difficult to do.
Well, congratulations on your research and long may it continue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you both. Cheers. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder, you can always tune in to the debate at Go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.